Hey, let's start the show.
It's July 11th, 2013. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Will Smith, directly to my left, looking at what appears to be some sort of touch-based computer. Norman Chan.
It is indeed a touch-based computer.
I like the color.
I don't know. It's a post-PC, I guess. No, it's a PC.
It's part of the new Microsoft One strategy, which we'll talk about later. To your left, Norman, Wesley Fenlon.
Hey, guys. What's up?
Hey, Wes. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Before we start, I guess we have some bad news to report. It's something that if you follow Tested or Giant Bomb or any of the people that worked at Whiskey on Twitter, then you probably already know. But our dear friend Ryan Davis passed away last week. And, I mean, we've talked about it on the site. We've posted stuff
hopefully not
different places.
News to you at this point.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess, yeah. It's hit us all. You know, it's always a tragedy to have someone taken when they're that young as Ryan was, is, and made worse, I think, by the fact that he was married the week before, when we were at his wedding. Well, Norm and I were at his wedding, I guess.
Yeah, we just talked about that wedding experience on last week's podcast, which just unfortunately went up on the same day that we all found out. I mean, by now it's Thursday that we're recording this, and the news went out on Monday. Pretty much everyone has chimed in to talk about their experience, and this might be a good time for us to talk about some stories about Ryan. And I think that's what the Bomb Guys did on their podcast, and that was a great episode they did this week.
It was cathartic, I would say.
And we all have our little nuggets of Ryan memories, so. Sharing time.
I told the story on a blog post. But the first real interaction I had with Ryan, because he was one of those people that you kind of saw at events and stuff like that. He and Jeff, obviously, and Brad.
You couldn't miss him. He was so loud.
Yeah, like they were at you nailed it, Norm. At press, when you'd go to press events and the Bomb, and prior to that, even the GameSpot guys were there. Like, those were the dudes that were having fun, and everybody else was doing super serious interviews and you know, being – they were playing games but not having fun. And those guys always seem to be having fun.
And it's something that it kind of makes sense for a business when you're writing and reporting about video games, because sensibly people have fun when they play video games. But it's something that we don't even see today, you know, in tech or anything, or maybe in sports a little bit. Sports announcers have fun, but
that's a real scripted kind of not. Anyway,
yeah.
The point is, we didn't really know these guys before we started at Whiskey. I had a lot of professional respect for what Ryan and Jeff and Brad and Vinny and the guys at Bomb do and did. But we weren't friends. And when we came into Whiskey, like the first interaction I think Norm and I had with Ryan was when he was teaching us how to work the podcast stuff. Because before we started.
You know what? We'd been podcasting for several years before then, but he taught us how to podcast.
Well, yeah, we had...
How to, like, not just the technical side, how to podcast.
Yeah. So before we had... When we were at Maximum PC, we had a dedicated producer, first Jeremy Williams and then Andy Bauman, who actually is now at CBSI with Comic Vine.
And Bomb.
And he does and videos Bomb. For Bomb.
He does
yeah.
video. Yeah, it's come full circle. Like we did, those guys handled all the production stuff. So we just basically sat down and shot the shit for an hour. I thought we did good podcasts. They were entertaining and we had fun with them, but we didn't like, we always kept it. We made fake radio shows, not podcasts is kind of the way I look at it now.
Yeah. People in the early days and still today, they podcast like a radio show and
like radio shows with curse. Like if you keep it to 23 minutes, cause that's how long your show needs
oh
to
my
be.
God, I can't even imagine.
Yeah. We kept on topic at Max PC more or less. Occasionally Gordon would completely lose his shit, but you know, it was a very structured show. And both Ryan first taught us how to use the equipment and then was basically like, look, you motherfuckers need to just talk more and be human beings and stop trying to make a fucking radio show. And
by comparison, the Bomb guys were kind of like the heirs to what 1UP sort of started with, like their gaming podcast that tons and tons of people loved, and they had all these personalities.
Yeah, Brodeo.
And then, yeah, and then, you know, over time, a lot of those people got laid off and like the huge exodus. And I don't remember the exact timing on that. So maybe Giant Bomb was already around
I think they'd been doing the hotspot and stuff like that for a long time.
Yeah,
by then.
But clearly they absolutely defined what, you know, a personality-driven gaming podcast should be like, or just podcasts in general.
But the upshot out of all of this is that I thought Ryan really fucking hated me when we started, because I didn't know... Like, the thing that he did that I've never met anybody else who really did effectively was he just absolutely wore your ass out if he liked you. If he didn't like you, he kind of ignored you. But if he liked you, you got incessant shit, and it was on air and off air the whole time, like you know... No mercy at all from Ryan. And like that, when we started doing things like happy hours and doing more stuff that we interacted with them, I really came to appreciate that was like his way of making everybody better at what they did. Like he would like make your joke better by being merciless about it if it was a bad joke, or by writing it as far as it would go if it was a good joke. And it was wonderful to get to work with him and to get to watch he and Jeff and the rapport that they have. Like, I've never seen two people that work the same way and at such a high level off of each other, to the point that when they started going, everybody else was left in the dust.
There was
in a good
way. Great video that someone embedded from when they came back from the E3 and did a swag giveaway, and it was like a fake...
It was like the knife show is what they were trying to do, I think.
Pretty much. Like not as seen on TV, but the Home Shopping Network show. And they were on the entire time. It was really amazing. It's weird. I think working with Ryan was a lot of fun. I feel like I didn't know him as well as a lot of people did. In terms of hanging out with him one-on-one outside of work. But I went through a lot of my IM conversations with him this week, just in backlogs. And it's brought back a lot of fun memories. He is responsible for me having those Star Wars posters in my house.
He gave you the heads up on...
He put me, not just the heads up, he got the hook up for that. He flew down to L.A. to... hang out with Ollie Moss, his first show in the U.S., and then texted me when he was down there to see if I wanted anything at that show and help buy some stuff for me.
Were you guys into that stuff at the same time?
Yeah.
Or okay, yeah.
When you said if he was interested in you, if he was fascinated by you as a person, he would let you know it, And he's had a really good eye for interesting things and comedy, and a good ear for comedy. And
he was unbelievably fast.
And yeah, it was
like I think people understand this, but I like those bits, the things that we did on the brick set during the happy hour. The very best ones were when he was either super pissed off about something we were doing, like eating horrible food with our mouths open on camera, or just thought that what we were doing was the stupidest fucking thing in the world, which was frequently done on, like, we did that on purpose.
Yeah, but you played the straight man.
Yeah.
But it was legitimate. I mean, yeah.
There was no fake rage, no. But none of that was script. Like, none of that was, like, we didn't discuss that beforehand. None of that stuff was planned well enough to actually do, to have any kind of canned responses or for him to even know what the hell we were going to do. It was getting to learn from him and watching the way he worked and the way he worked with Jeff and the rest of the Bomb guys was pretty special and something I'll always really cherish. So,
yeah, I mean, like everyone said, it was as unfathomable and terrible as what happened last week. It was really nice that we all got to see him the week before at his happiest. And
I mean, that's the way I always remember him. Yeah. The last thing I'm going to say is that the Giant Bomb guys said, hey, they don't encourage people putting graffiti. Like, there was an awesome picture of some dude who had graffitied a giant, Ryan's initials, and then his Twitter name, Tazwell, on the side of a building. And they were like, no, we don't encourage. Fuck yeah, you should paint his name everywhere. That was awesome. So whoever did that is you know, I'm generally anti-graffiti, but in this case, go for it.
I think that was in the UK.
Yeah, that's fine. It's right. Totally cool there, that's right?
It's not our
other side of the world. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he would know. Yeah, and he was just he had really good taste in everything. And
no, he didn't. He fucked Torque, no. Man. Have you ever watched Torque? No, that is a terrible movie.
He
loved awful stuff for all the right reasons. Which, I mean, you know, and he'd laugh. He'd call us assholes for talking about it this long. So, we'll miss you, buddy.
I think, like, I didn't know Ryan nearly as well as you guys. Obviously, I worked in the Whiskey Media office, you know, a day a week or so for...
You were there.
For a while, and didn't really interact with the Bomb guys much, but to say that two of my favorite Giant Bomb memories are just moments where he completely lost his shit laughing. One, at the last Big Live show when Norm said... China don't mind.
Yeah, that was just like a random thing, and he could not stop laughing.
He just about passed out in his chair.
Yeah.
And the other one was when the Buckner and Garcia.
Oh my god, that was amazing!
Came out and just you guys had the flip cam video of him just rolling on the floor in response to that song.
I was so there's two things that are really funny about that video. One is that Ben shot it, so the perspective is insanely high.
He's like 9 feet off.
Yeah, because he's like 7 feet tall. The other is that when he got that email, and there were two times that he completely lost his shit while he was sitting in his chair that I remember. One was the day that Ice-T called him. I don't know if you were there for that day, but like he completely lost his mind. And of course we were in that basement, so cell phone reception was always really sketchy, and like you could just see him, he completely froze when the call came, and he was just like, oh my god, I'm talking to Ice-T, and if I move my hand in the slightest, the phone could drop. So I'm not gonna absolutely. And then when he hung up, he just was like, I just talked to Ice fucking T. The other was the Buckner and Garcia moment, and he literally fell out of his chair. I thought he'd hurt himself or like something bad had happened, and he was just laughing his ass off on the floor, rolling around like a giant baby. It was pretty awesome.
And a good song too.
And yeah, it was an okay song. So yeah, there's the thread on Giant Bomb is a wonderful testimony to him. If you haven't looked at it, you should go. At least if you love Ryan like we do.
And they're gonna announce a new T-shirt or something that they're gonna sell.
We'll link about it. We'll post about it on the Tested when we find out what it is and when it's coming up. And then there's other stuff. Ollie Moss did this amazing portrait of him and his favorite Pokemon. Which I think is coughing. Is that right?
That is the name of that Pokemon. With the K.
And then Steve. I mean, there's a bunch of great art posted on the forums.
See, Ollie Moss did those, and he was friends with Ollie, and he did these random Pokemon sales. There's an IM that I pulled up where he IM'd me asking me which Pokemon I want. I got because you chose the one you wanted, and we both chose Charmander. And he was like, "God damn it! You know, the Pokemon chooses you."
Too many Charmanders.
Too many Charmanders.
Too many Charmanders.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff. Yeah. Yeah, he did. In our office, he like really was like a great friend. I remember when what's his name was an engineer at the office. God, I don't remember his name. The guy was on Jeopardy.
Ted. He wasn't on Jeopardy.
He applied for Jeopardy. Ted.
Hardcore Ted? What was his nickname? We had a nickname for him, too.
The fact that I forgot his name.
Fades.
But he was a big Star Trek fan, and Ryan hooked him up with these amazing Star Trek posters that Ollie did also. And, yeah, he was... It was just like... how excited he got about things that he was interested in was really, really infectious and genuine. And things like Disneyland and... Mickey Mouse, even, and Tron.
Just the joy, like the joy of life, and he celebrated every single day. So, let that be a lesson to you out there. Celebrate every day. Yeah. Andy really loves.
And if you
Tor.
Don't know, if you have no idea who Ryan it was,
is
there hundreds and hundreds of videos online that you should go watch.
Thousands of hours of dumb videos. If you go to Giant Bomb right now, all of the stuff in their promo slots and those things at the top of the page are the community selections of his best videos. So if you don't know, then just start with the first video on the page and just start watching.
And you know, even if you have no interest in video games,
this ain't no game.
Yeah, go watch the first and a half season of Tang, This Ain't No Game, which is the video series he did at Giant Bomb about video game adaptations, movie adaptations,
yeah,
including Mortal Kombat and
Super Mario Brothers,
Super Mario Brothers, and all that stuff.
War Games.
Yeah. That series stands on its own as some of the best stuff he ever did.
It's great. That and the Liverpool travelogue video are the Beatles themed cafe menu items is still one of my favorite. Like, every once in a while he'd be sitting in his chair and just blast out one. I don't know where he and Vinny came up with that, except for that I guess they were in Liverpool, so it made sense. But it was pretty dumb and real good. I mean, Ryan was the epitome of the dumb, never stupid, right? Which is
never lame.
Never lame.
Always stupid, never lame.
Yeah. So anyway, we love you, buddy, and we miss you. I really don't want to talk about tech news, but there's been a bunch that's happened, so I guess we probably should.
That's what people want. Start right at the top.
List. T-Mobile announced a jump, their new jump plan.
T-Mobile did they play the song to go with it?
The Van Halen song?
No. Jump? I know what you're thinking.
Jump?
Yeah.
That's a Van Halen song.
Is it?
Jump is a Van Halen song. I'm going to go look right now because I don't even want to deal with the comments if this goes badly. But yeah,
T-Mobile is like they're the anti-hero of carriers. AT&T and Verizon as cellular carriers own so much of the market, and T-Mobile. I mean, for a long time they were piggybacking on other network infrastructure.
Okay, I got to stop.
Is that the song?
That's not what I was
thinking.
I was thinking the hip-hop song.
Yeah, you're thinking about Cypress Hill. Jump around. Jump around.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yes.
Okay. Well, this clear generation gap is actually called Jump. You fucking millennials. You're what's wrong with America today.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Is Norm a millennial?
No.
When were you born, Norm?
84.
You're a millennial, dude.
No.
After 1980.
Norm has a job. He's not a millennial.
Yeah.
This is true.
I'm a willennial. T-Mobile. For the longest time, they bought a bunch of spectrum. They've been building up the infrastructure. It's very expensive, but still in third place.
Are they still owned by Deutsche Telekom? Are they part of the European?
I want to say there was an attempt to merge or
come. Well, AT&T tried to buy them.
Yeah, I think they're still. Yeah,
they're still part of the. Yeah. Okay.
So they a couple months ago launched the contract free plan. So they don't have 2-year contracts anymore if you don't want.
Yep.
If you want it, you can still be on a 2-year contract and do the old plan. But I think it's like $50 a month for your fake 4G.
What do you mean fake 4G? HSPA?
HSPA Plus. Like they're one of the first people who called HSPA Plus 4G. But now they have LTE also, and LTE I think is another $10 more. But that's still much cheaper than, for example, what I pay, which is $100 a month for LTE.
Yeah.
And even though they do have caps, like they have 500 megs, 2 gigs, and unlimited, they really don't cap you if you reach that cap. It's or charge overages. It's just capping the speed to edge, so you don't get cut off completely.
That's the way AT&T works as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so...
So they also, in addition to that, they also got the iPhone. This is a couple months ago.
And when they did the plan, like, you get a different rate if you have a subsidized phone, right? Wasn't that part of their deal?
Their deal with the iPhone was that you could buy it on with an installment plan.
Oh, right.
For you would do a $100 down payment, and then you'd pay $20 a month for 24 months. So that would be kind of like a contract. So... If I imagine, I'm basically paying you know, $200 for an iPhone at AT&T, and then add $20 a month, or because it's a 2-year contract, that makes that puts the T-Mobile contract free plan and this installment plan kind of on parity with an AT&T or Verizon subsidized 2-year contract. Except for the T-Mobile side, you could, you know, pay it all at once and then, or get off the T-Mobile contract whenever you want. What they announced yesterday is this really weird, interesting plan called Jump, which is it's not a service plan. It is more of a subscription. And the idea is that you pay $10 a month, which gives you the opportunity. One, it gives you insurance on your existing phone, which they sell today for $8 a month. And insurance means if it's...
if you smash it, you get a replacement.
If it's stolen, you get a replacement for, I think, a fairly
reasonable rate. It's a deductible, right? It's like $100 or $200, right?
Yeah, and depending on how long you've been on the subscription, you have to be on it for a certain amount of time. But if you subscribe and subscribe to Jump for and go on for 6 months, then you can upgrade your phone and get and trade it in for a new phone for basically free. Oh, no penalty.
No,
not free.
It's the on-contract price.
No penalty.
Right. So right now, if you buy a phone from AT&T and you go on contract for 2 years, at a certain period of time in the future, based on how much you pay every month, you will be able to get the on-contract price again and renew your contract at the same time.
Which is but usually 18 to 24 months.
That's 12 to 18 months, depending on what
you spend. Have they started kind of, I don't want to say cracking down on that, but did they kind of cut back on it in the past? Because I feel like the first, you know, like 3 or 4 iPhone cycles, everybody was doing like, a lot of people were getting the...
There was a reason to upgrade
the
every
1 year
time.
Upgrade, and they were letting people do that. And I seem like
they did
a
crack
lot
down.
Of people
so
in the last
how
couple
they've
years,
cracked down yeah. is that they will give you a middle tier discounted rate.
Right. So it's like $150 plus the contract price, basically.
It's okay. you add another $250.
It's prorated usually, I think.
No, it's a flat thing. It's been flat.
At that point, it really seems like you should think hard about just getting an unlocked phone.
Yeah.
Well,
unlocked phones can be very
unlocked phones are $600, $800,
$650.
But
for
if
the
you're
cheapest
paying
one.
Another $200 for your contract and then
and
what, $100,
and renewing
on top
the contract,
of that? Yeah,
yeah,
like.
So I did the math on this when I did a mid-cycle upgrade to the iPhone 4S, which was the shittiest mid-cycle upgrade of all time. It was cheaper to do the mid-cycle if you upgraded every year. Like rather than pay full price 1 year and get on contract the next, it was cheaper to do the mid-cycle. But the point
is, if you're on contract and you plan to see the big trick is you need to be planned for the future. It's not just how much you're paying up front. You need to plan what your actions are potentially going to be in the next year, 2 years, and 3 years.
Yeah.
If you are starting out like and no one's starting out basically as a you know fresh plan right now. But if you are, you have the option of being on a 2-year plan, which means you could wait 2 years, upgrade a phone. You could wait 1 year, pay, and then, which means you're renewing your subscription, which means it's really a 3-year plan. Or if you're on T-Mobile and you're doing this Jump thing, you also have to factor in your installment plan, which is 24 months after your last phone upgrade.
Right. So the way this works is you pay $10 a month additionally, which is insurance, like you said, and this service as well. And in exchange for doing that for at least 6 months, you can upgrade your phone twice a year at the on contract price. Now, there's a catch, because the catch is you turn in your old phone at the same time.
Well, the catch also is the on contract price means that you're still paying an installment plan between your first phone and your second phone. So you're still like it's not like you're paying $200 and that's the phone. You're paying $100.
Yeah, you keep paying $10 a month.
And you keep paying $20 a month as an installment plan and a $10 a month subscription.
Hold on, I didn't think the installment plan was part of this.
It's totally part of the installment plan.
Oh, right. And you hand in your phone at the
and
same
you
time,
hand in your phone.
Which could have a value of between $200 and $500 depending on which phone you have.
Yeah.
So it is GigaOm, one of the writers at GigaOm did the math. And basically what he came up with is if you upgrade your phone once a year or more, it makes sense. If you upgrade your phone every year to 2 years to 3 years, like the longer you between upgrades you go, the less it makes sense.
And it only makes sense if you then after you have to stop at some point and stop paying that $10 a month and say this is the last time
I'm upgrading for a while.
I'm no longer going to be upgrade you know twice a year. Then stop paying that $10 a month and then cash out. You have to cash out.
Yeah. So the The other thing that's the big hitch for me is that you have to, like, if you're the kind of person that has phones and you never sell them or give them to other people, then go for it. But if you are, if at least in the iPhone, the used iPhone market,
which is not nearly as big as it used to be,
but you can still get $400 for a used iPhone.
No.
Especially if it's unlocked.
I don't think they. No, it used to be that people like T-Mobile customers would pay a ton of money for a used iPhone, and it'd be really easy going Craigslist. Now, not nearly as much.
I gave my 4S's and 4s to my parents, so I don't know what they're.
Yeah,
like
I gave
last time
four,
I sold
I
one
gave
was a 3GS.
I also gave my 4 and 4S to my parents because I couldn't get squat for them online.
Oh, okay.
It's interesting that the math apparently works out well for doing this upgrade. You know, more than once a year or more, just because you would think that's when your phone would potentially have the most resale value.
Well, it's when the phone has the most resale value for them, because I'm sure they're going to start selling used phones.
Right.
Yeah, so you have to really factor in, you know, one. I mean, what type of phone user are you that you would be getting a new phone every 6 months? One, you have to be like on probably two different platforms, maybe an Android phone. That
yeah, if you're
sense.
An
there
Android
are,
user.
Android, new Android phones. I guess last year you could have done a S4 and then an HTC One and really just swap between them. But if you're on iPhone, it makes no sense unless you're swapping between platforms.
You know, the place this saves you is if you buy a phone on contract and you make a mistake. So what if suppose you buy a Windows phone and realize that you fucked up really badly.
Yeah, if you want to experiment with OSs, sure.
Yeah, then that gives you a little bit of safety so that you pay your $60 over a six-month period and then you can switch from the Windows phone to an Android or Android phone or an iPhone. And then you're back on something that's good. So it reduces the punishment for experimenting from 2 years to 6 months potentially, which is I think a good thing. The thing that's really good about all of this is that they're applying pressure to AT&T and Verizon and Sprint to change the traditional 2 year model, because the thing that happens right now is a 2 year old phone is ancient. In today's terms, like the lifespan of a phone in the feature phone days, two or three, four. I mean, I kept feature phones for 4 years sometimes.
I think yes, technically that's true, but I think people are still upgrading their phones way too frequently, and that's a lot of it's because they in their head the phone is $200 and not $650.
No, I agree.
If you're buying a if you're paying full price for phones, like many people outside of the U.S. do. Then you're keeping it for at least a year and a half.
Do you think the next few cycles of phones is something we're gonna slow down on or not feel like they are total crap by the end of its lifespan?
They're reaching a point where, like, if you have an iPhone 4 right now, it's not as crappy as an iPhone 3 would have been in the same period in its life cycle.
Because after a year,
stable out to some extent.
So after a year and a half with the HTC Evo, I was super done with it.
But like, that was a first gen Android phone, essentially.
It was a Froyo phone.
It was a one point. It was, no, but I mean, if you look at when Android became a real product, which was between the Galaxy Nexus and the Nexus One and the I'm sorry, not the Galaxy Nexus, the Nexus One and the Droid, the original Droid, like the HTC Incredible was the next phone that came out after the Droid, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it was a ways in. Like, it was kind of at the beginning of the super phone, you know, huge screen movement. But obviously, I haven't had the iPhone 5 for a year and a half yet. It's been like 10 months.
Yeah.
Because they got it right when it came out. And it feels like day one new to me still in terms of just how well it functions.
Yeah, once the ARM CPUs and the kind of graphics platforms became a little more. If you look at the base level of iOS being an iPhone 4 these days, and the base level of Android being a dual core ARM CPU with a Tegra 2 or something like that in it, then yeah, we're in it's okay. Everything like you're going to be okay with that hardware. The things that start to happen is the phone gets banged up and looks crappy. The battery starts to work less well.
I think battery is probably the big thing that after 2 years, you know, that might be your big reason to upgrade if the battery is at like 60-70% of what it was when you got it.
There's always battery upgrade service.
So I'm interested to see what the response, if any, from Verizon and AT&T are.
I predict
to this.
No response.
I would kind of think so at this point, but at some point they'll have to address it if it becomes a successful product. If people start switching to T-Mobile from AT&T to Verizon as a result of this, then yeah, of course they're going to switch. They'll change stuff up. Right now, the Verizon upgrade policy is real grim.
Let us know if you plan on switching to T-Mobile, because I think this is less of an incentive to switch T-Mobile than the $50 a month contract-free plan.
Well, I think
that was
probably
their best move.
But I think in aggregate, you're looking at a much more consumer-friendly carrier here. At least that's going to be the external perception. And if that's the case, like I fucking hate that. I've never had a phone company that I liked. Have you?
It's like, what matters most is service in terms of the quality
coverage.
Yeah. And I don't care if their QA is terrible and their customer support's terrible and their billing is terrible, but as long as I can get phone coverage and cellular service and data service, that's all I care about.
Do you feel the same way about every ISP you've ever had?
Pretty much. No, I had one really great ISP once 20 years ago, and I lived in Tennessee. They were fantastic.
A couple of my friends who live in Georgia work at a local-ish, state-level ISP / power provider, and they regularly get callers, about internet issues or whatever, and they help those people. But also when they don't have other things to do and people call in and are like, my email doesn't work, like they help those people out.
Great, for some people.
Part of a customer service program.
But you know, as nice as those people are, I would rather have just fast, reliable internet.
Well, they have that too.
Yeah.
But
that takes precedence over
everything.
It's just
such a, like, that thinking of that image of like, here is an internet service provider that not only works most of the time, but unlike Comcast, when you call them because your laptop doesn't work right, you're not talking to a robot.
Somebody reading a script.
Someone reading a script. Yeah. It's like somebody who doesn't have anything else to do, so they're going to troubleshoot your hard drive.
I mean, just to be clear, I have no beef with the people on the Comcast support lines. I've talked to a bunch of them over the last 3 years because my internet's been so shitty.
They don't have the nicest jobs.
But yeah, I mean, they are, when you work in that kind of call center, you're required to work down the flow chart, and they don't have free will when it comes to doing tech support, right? Anyway, do we talk about the Apple ebook stuff? There's been a lawsuit for a while.
The price fixing.
It's not a suit. It's a DOJ investigation.
So the ruling came down.
Yeah, the ruling came down that Apple did indeed what was the exact verbiage? Something about uncompetitive behavior. Basically, they said that they did something that's against the rules when they got all the publishers together and said, "Hey guys, you don't have to do this. You can do this other thing instead." And all the other publishers, of course, settled, and Apple seems to be worried about looking evil or something, so they have not.
The thing that I find kind of funny about it is that who buys ebooks from Apple anyway?
Yeah, I mean, Apple's point is actually kind of valid in this, and I'm usually anti, what they did is in the letter of the law, not a legal thing, right, as I understand it. I'm not a lawyer, but...
Well, did you see what the evidence was? A lot of emails came out, a lot of phone calls, and one evidence that apparently compelled the judge to rule against Apple was a video from Wall Street Journal, All Things D, where Walt Mossberg, Uncle Walt, talked to Steve Jobs at the, I believe,
like
2010.
D7?
No, 2010 iPad unveiling.
Okay.
At the Apple event. And Walt Mossberg was sitting on this table at the event and talking to Jobs. And
sitting on the table?
Sitting on the table. And it's funny because someone said he's never seen anyone at an Apple event sit on one of those demo tables.
No.
And Walt Mossberg was just lounging around sitting there looking at the iPad and oh, what's this? It's kind of interesting. And he's talking to Steve Jobs, who's with his shit-eating grin on his face. Right, and then he's like, "Oh," and in the video, which is a All Things Wall Street Journal All Things D video, I think Carl Swisher shot it. Walt asks, Amazon charges $10. How are you going to get away with charging $15? And Steve Jobs says, "It's all the prices will be the same," and smiles.
Dun dun dun.
They'll be
very
the same.
Sinister. And of course, Steve can't testify from beyond the grave. So, the interesting thing to me about this is that Amazon has. Over the last 15 years of its existence or 17 years of existence, whatever, consistently come into new markets, sold products at a loss until they ran out all the competitors and then jacked up prices. So, that was their strategy with ebooks. They wanted to build an ebook market, so they started selling Kindles. They sold for day one hardback, what would have been day one hardback books at $25 or $30 for $9.99 if you invested in their $250 device. And that got a lot of people who, like myself, who read a lot and like technology, to shell out for a Kindle.
And the hardware became so good that people, like, that's one of the areas of digital goods where people don't really care about DRM too much, right? Like, you know, you buy a book on Amazon and it has DRM on it, and some people don't love that, but generally people are happy enough with the Kindle that they don't care too much.
Well, and the thing that Amazon sussed out really early that Apple still hasn't figured out, Google gets this now, it seems like, is that people don't give a shit about DRM if what you're getting is more convenient than the analog good. So
convenience, as Valve has demonstrated, right, is really the key here.
Amazon has released Kindle apps on every platform that I've ever used.
If you want to read your Amazon books on a Kobo, you're shit out of luck, but who wants to do
I
that?
Think you can probably even sideload the Android Kindle app on the Kobo at this point,
like,
right?
Well, and if you use like a Calibre, like one of the ebook libraries.
Calibre.
Like Calibre. I think that you can get around the DRM stuff pretty easily.
Have you used that?
I have.
I'm a little finicky about formatting and stuff on ebooks, but I have had nothing but bad luck with that. And I would love to talk to you maybe offline or at a different time.
Yeah, I haven't used
about
it a ton, but I always found it a pretty good program. Like, it was a little slow, a little bit.
I'm fine with slow. I don't mind
clunky,
that.
But I've had like books that aren't available in ebook format that I found, like, you know, like a text file version of or something, and I wanted to like reread it.
I hope it's public domain stuff, Wes.
No, like literally books that I am like holding.
Oh, okay.
And so I'll like try to get that on the Kindle or something. And sometimes in terms of like spacing, that stuff can get a little wonky. But from most of my experiences, like converting from one file type to another using that program and putting it on a Kindle, it's good enough to not bother me when I'm reading it.
Okay. Well, and for stuff that's not available otherwise, it makes sense.
Yeah, and it's a pretty decent like library management tool if you have multiple devices you're trying to sync stuff to, because you can just like choose, just like right click and say send to, you know, this device.
Well,
this device,
and now
whatever.
You can, like, when I bought books from the Humble ebook bundle, which is going again right now, it's another good list of books, by the way, if you're into that. I downloaded Kindle formatted versions of those books and then just sent them to the Kindle document service, and they were immediately on all my devices and iPad and all that stuff. So that's the thing that Amazon figured out. Apple fucked that up with the original iTunes DRM, because the only way you could play that stuff was on iTunes or on an Apple device.
On a single computer.
Five computers.
But you downloaded one at a time.
Exactly.
Do you think they really fucked that up, though? Because I feel like
they probably didn't have a choice.
The dominance that secured them with iPods and iTunes paid off. I mean,
I think... Well, they were the first place that you could buy music online that wasn't weird in some way, either like the weird e-music subscription stuff or the Rhapsody streaming or whatever. I think the limitations of that stuff were probably related to the music publishers not understanding how the internet was going to go one way or the other, whether they participated or not.
And things haven't really changed there.
Well, they're just irrelevant.
They're just bad in a different way.
Yeah. The Kindle DRM is good. Google seems to get this too. Like they have released music apps, and I mean they haven't released stuff for Windows Mobile, but that's because of the Microsoft kerfluffle they're having.
Google Music's pretty awesome.
Google Music's pretty good. You can get a Google Book app, a Google Play Store book app for iOS. I don't think they've released WebOS versions of that stuff, but like literally the Kindle app was available for WebOS. I mean, think about that for a minute. That was a product that lasted maybe 3 months, and they managed to jam out a Kindle app for that. So,
they were kind of day one on any new platform.
The point is the DOJ thing like is following the letter of the law and is missing the larger issue, which is that Amazon has pretty consistently behaved in ways that are not conducive to free market, a free market in a lot of industries. This is above our pay grade what we're talking about right now. But
can I read my Kindle books on Ouya?
Probably. You can sideload Android apps.
Yes.
I don't know if the touch interface probably won't work. Sorry. You can read the first page
still
of your Kindle books
it
on an Ouya. Mm-hmm. That stuff happened. Smarter people than us have talked about that on their sites, but worthy of note. A new iOS 7 beta hit this week.
It's beta 3.
Beta 3.
That's the one that, from all reports, is the one that if you want to dip your toe into the beta iOS beta waters, this is the one to get.
It is.
You can use it all day without having to restart your phone, which is something to say about
Springboard crashes occasionally.
About iOS betas.
Not that I know. There's two things that have happened. They changed Siri's voice is different. What's my next appointment?
You have two appointments today. That sounds just like the old Siri that I know.
Hold on.
That's
I got
Siri.
A different
is it
voice.
Siri's sister?
I got
Does Siri have a twin sister?
I got a different voice
Siri's
yesterday.
More,
I don't know how
more
I got
human,
it.
Human natural sister.
So maybe there isn't a Siri, different Siri voice, but
so
at
that,
one point,
that's still
Gina and
coming,
I were
maybe. Gina, I mean, they showed it off at the keynote or at WWC.
It may only be for certain responses too. Gina and I were in the car the other day, and I accidentally hit the Siri button. She was like, "What the hell was that?" Because it came out the car stereo, and she was like, "That's not the right voice. That's not Siri. That's a different voice."
Don't get too attached.
I'm not. The other thing is that the font has changed. Some of the fonts have changed.
This is probably a big deal if you care about fonts.
If you don't, I think it's all Comic Sans, right?
It is all Comic Sans, all the way down. What they did was for iOS 7, when they unveiled it, it was Helvetica
Nui
Light,
which is very thin,
which is a very thin font and kind of it's a delicate
font.
It was
how did you guys feel?
It was like an inhale.
Did you think it was? Did you have any issues with readability on that font on the beta?
I have not
used the beta.
So just Will.
See, here's the thing: the places where that font shows up are typically places where you already know what it's going to say. So it's things like the date on the calendar app, which I already it's usually something large. I didn't encounter that in A. I don't use many default Apple apps anymore. So the places that it showed up are things like the timer.
It shows up in
if you look at the timer,
Safari,
like the countdown time shows
all
up.
All the menus and stuff.
But the Safari menus, you don't look at settings.
That's what people.
Yeah, in settings was the big place, I guess. And I didn't have any trouble reading settings. Mail wasn't that bad though. And I actually usually use the Gmail app.
From looking at screenshots, I thought it looked pretty good.
It looks good in screenshots, but
it's the kind of thing that could kind of wear on you.
And it is exactly the type of thing that typography experts have come out and said. The thinner font, it looks great on a Retina-type display, a high-resolution display, but in terms of just sheer readability and glanceability, words are not going to be as readable. The spacing is not as good.
If you're clicking on your screen to look at the time and you have to do a double take, that's maybe a problem.
Yes, from a design point perspective, that's bad design. So they switched back to Helvetica Nui, and if you've been following iOS, you know that they went from Helvetica to Helvetica Nui, I believe, between the iPhone 3GS and 4. It's fine. I mean, the comparison screenshots, everything is back to normal.
Yeah, it's the other thing is most email you get these days, or a lot of the email you get these days, is HTML formatted. So the font that's the system font doesn't show up, which is why I didn't notice it in mail, I guess. I guess people are horrible and send me HTML email more often than not. I miss just text email. So that's the iOS 7 stuff. Earlier this week, a Navy X-47 drone landed on an aircraft carrier.
That's the first time this drone has done that.
It's the first time an unmanned drone has landed on an aircraft carrier.
So they've been testing this drone. This drone is not a drone that's going to be armed with weapons in the future. This is purely a drone to test unmanned autonomous flight. And it's taken off from airstrips. It's landed on airstrips.
It's landed on airstrips that were like sized, that were in a space marked out the size of an aircraft carrier with a.
But it's never before this week landed on a floating aircraft carrier.
Which I mean, if you've ever read books about naval aviation, that's widely regarded as the most difficult thing you can do in an airplane.
It did
you're landing
the day.
On something the size of three right night landings in a storm, I guess, are the worst. But even landing during the day on a carrier is a highly skilled maneuver. Something 3 football fields long, and you're landing a plane that hits at 120 or 130 miles an hour. So the interesting thing about this is that those drones are now retired. That's it.
It served their purpose.
Program is done. They're going to go to the Naval Aviation Museum and someplace else. One of the other interesting things about this drone, I thought, that I didn't know about is that the Navy's drones behave differently than Air Force drones. So Air Force drones are remote piloted. These are remote controlled, I think is the term. So instead of actually a person sitting on a trailer someplace with a satellite uplinked to the drone saying, okay, moving a stick and then the drone follows that command within the lag of the satellite communications later, the Navy drones, you just issue them instructions and they kind of follow them. So it's more like an RTS unit to put it in.
So they say, like, go to these GPS coordinates at this speed or something, and it just goes.
Exactly. And instead of lining up the cursor crosshair and pulling the trigger, I assume I don't think the Navy has drones that are this advanced yet. But I think the theory is you'll say fly to this area and then shoot, blow up this thing.
If you can't do manual barrel rolls, what's the point, really?
Okay, Fippy. So yeah, that's the X-47 drone. You'll be able to see them in museums soon. They're going to be in Naval Air Museums. I think one's in Pensacola or Florida someplace, and I can't remember where the other one's going. IDC reported that PC sales are down 11.4% from this time last year, which is shockingly better than estimates. But I think the estimated sales drop was 11.7%. Lenovo is the leader in shipping PCs right now. They're the sales leader. So they've taken over from Acer or Asus, who were the previous leaders.
Judging by the yoga, they're doing a pretty good job.
I mean, the thing about...
does that count as a PC?
Yeah. It does, absolutely. Yeah.
If it has an x86 processor and a keyboard and a screen, it is a PC. I wonder if Surface Pros count as PCs. They have to, right?
They do count as PCs.
But probably didn't move the needle too much. Miramax films are coming to Amazon Instant, so that means Amelie and Pulp Fiction and
Kevin Smith's movies before the Weinstein Company.
So that means up until Zach and Miri, probably. So that stuff's all going to be on Amazon Instant. Good news. Today they announced, Microsoft announced it's the big reorg. This is the one Microsoft initiative. Ballmer has been working on this for a while, apparently.
Do you think he's been sitting in a room just like playing with little figures? Like
I'm not like mature. Lone Star 5?
Nope, you're gone.
Throw him in the trash.
Yep. I'm like, oh, I'm gonna select this group of people. They're gonna lead my divisions.
So
my tribes.
So I'm going to read a couple quotes from the email that went out to all Microsoft employees. Going forward, this is the new... Okay, so for the first, let's say, 25 or 30 years of Microsoft's existence, because it was founded in 1975, the goal was to get a PC on every desk and in every home in the world, right? It started
done.
On every desk
done.
And then in every home. Now they're in everybody's pocket for all intents and purposes. So mission accomplished. Nice job, guys. The new strategy, the new focus, the new... one goal is going forward, our strategy will focus on creating a family of devices and services for individuals and businesses that empower people around the globe at home, at work, and on the go for the activities they value most.
We're going to do things for you, the things you want to do.
It's not quite as good as a PC on every desk and in every home.
What are the activities we value most?
Well, that's, you know... There's a list. You want me to read them?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to know what I value most. Yeah.
Reinventing expression and documents. People love and need to express themselves in new ways. Documents are going from being printed to being experienced. So they're talking multimedia, guys. Multimedia.
I do appreciate documents.
Next generation decision-making and task completion. Our machine learning infrastructure will understand people's needs and what is available in the world and will provide information and assistance. We will be great at anticipating needs and people's daily routines and providing insight and assistance when they need it.
So what we really appreciate is not doing things.
That sounds like iRobot stuff. The only way to save us is to enslave us.
Microsoft has such a fundamental communication problem in the PR, and a lot of it's because the Kool-Aid there is really strong.
They don't speak English anymore.
That if you compare them to, for example, Apple, and their big thing is we want to make products that delight people. That's it. That's their one line. And Google, their one line is, we want to make the Star Trek computer.
I thought their line was, don't be evil.
Nah, I think they changed it to, we want to make the Star Trek computer.
Okay. a bunch of fucking nerds.
And everything now is building toward that. And all their services and everything is Star Trek computer. It's so simple. It's so easy to get, and yet opens this world of possibilities.
There's two more things.
And that's just messaging, right?
That's just messaging.
Well, it's because they don't talk like humans in Redmond right. anymore. Social communication, meetings, events, gathering, sharing, and communicating. Social communications are time-intensive, high-value scenarios that are ripe for digital reimagination.
Ugh. I just feel like they really need to go back to the Chandler video.
Jennifer Aniston.
The Jennifer Aniston.
The Friends video?
Yeah, the Friends video where they learn about Windows 95.
Yeah.
Or John Carmack.
They should just take that video of Chandler and Rachel sitting around the computer being like, whoa, there's a start button. You can drag and drop documents and then just be like,
I can connect to the internet.
And then just do some, you know,
what?
Put a modern UI over it and be like, look what we can do now. It's so much better than it used to be. Buy Windows. We're cool.
The last category of things that you want to do are serious fun. This expression may sound like an oxymoron, yet it encapsulates an important point of differentiation for us. There are many things people do for light fun. For example, play solitaire, spend 3 minutes on a word game, or surf the TV. Norm, when was the last time you surfed the TV?
Like on a TV or?
Surf the TV, Wes. That's the phrase. Although we will enable these activities effectively, our biggest opportunities in creating the fun people feel most intensely, such as playing a game that lasts hours and takes real concentration, or immersing themselves in live events and entertainment. I'm going to stab myself in the eyeball now. The other thing that they said is that as devices proliferate, it has become clearer that consumers crave one experience across all of their technology. I fundamentally don't know that that is true.
And that is their, if you want to boil down the simple messaging in their ads right now, it's
yeah.
one experience, all devices.
One Windows.
That is sticking to exactly why Windows 8 has been a failure.
Well, yeah, because and just to be clear,
are you saying
I don't,
things cannot be separate but equal?
Oh no, don't make this about race.
Oh, is it communism?
I here's the thing. I don't think that having one UI across phones and tablets and TVs and laptops is necessarily a bad thing. They haven't executed it yet. It usually takes Microsoft a few tries to get anything right. So, you know, maybe by this time in 2015 we'll be looking at a one Microsoft UI that actually is good. But right now, you know, this also makes the Xbox One branding make a lot more sense. The next version of Windows is going to be called Windows One, guys.
I mean, and the fact that it freaking has, like, Windows on it. Like, it is, like, running two separate OS layers
yes.
or totally different platforms in some, like, weird Frankenstein.
Hypervisor.
Yeah, like, combination, which is potentially... could be really awesome
yeah.
if it works out, but it's definitely strange.
When I went to launch the Twitch TV app on my Xbox the other day and it took 45 seconds for it to load, not counting download time or anything, like just from clicking the launch this app to when it actually showed me a screen, I understood the problem with not having a hypervisor and multiple, you know, having a real OS on there. A lot of this seems to still be like the Ballmer Gates vision of three screens that we heard about at CES in 2001 or 2002, you know, literally 10 or 12 years ago, which was that there would be a phone, a computer, and the living room, the TV. They owned the PC at that point, and they were doing pretty good in the phone stuff even back then.
And they took a shot at the IPTV?
Well, they whiffed the TV like two or three times in new ways. The Xbox One is clearly the latest in a shot at that. They launched the Xbox, even though they said they weren't trying to take over the living room with media and computer stuff. Clearly, that's the long-term goal, or what became the long-term goal when it became a success.
All we need is Ballmer to hold up the Xbox One.
And start talking about developers?
Screaming. No, hold up like the PS3 was held up in the center of your living room. That's why it's that's so expensive.
That is possible.
Get a second job to buy one.
So they announced who the executives are in charge of stuff, and this is the best part of all. So the divisions are devices, OSs, hardware, advanced strategy and research, applications and services engineering, biz dev and evangelism, and then some server shit that I'm not going to talk about, and financial and marketing. Terry Meyerson, who was formerly in charge of Windows Mobile, now owns all OSs. That means Windows, Xbox OS, Windows Phone, and server and cloud stuff, core cloud stuff, like the underlying Azure, the stuff that makes Azure work, I assume, is all now Terry Meyerson. Julie Larson Green, who formerly was in charge of Windows, and she was on stage at Build last week talking about Windows, is going to run hardware. That means, or 2 weeks ago, sorry. That means she's in charge of development and supply chain for Xbox, PC hardware, games, and I think also entertainment. This is unclear. That might mean like what was formerly Microsoft Studios, the in-house teams that are building games.
Taking the place of Don Matrick.
Kind of, but that also means Matrick didn't do Surface, didn't do PC mice and keyboards. It means that she's in charge of Xbox One hardware and accessories and ecosystem, more or less soup to nuts, except for the OS, which is Terry Myerson. Eric Rutter, who was the CTO before, is running advanced strategy and research, which includes Microsoft Research and Labs and stuff like that. So long-term development. Ki Lu was formerly in charge of search and now runs application services engineering, which is Office, Bing, Microsoft, MSN, Office 365, Skype, Yammer, all the software stuff that they have. So the stuff that runs on top of Azure, the computing cloud, belongs to him. The other stuff belongs to Terry Myerson. And then Tony Bates, who was of Skype before, is in charge of biz dev and evangelism. People are speculating that he is Ballmer's right-hand man under this new regime. The financial structure, instead of being separate P&Ls for each of the Microsoft divisions, which used to be Office, Windows, Xbox, server stuff, I can't remember the way the rest of it worked. Now all the P&Ls are theoretically going to be unified so that they can't say, okay, this division lost a shitload of money this year, this division made a bunch of money. It means that basically there's a lot of weight on Xbox, Windows, and Office still, and Windows Phone as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this pans out. Like, this is... It seems really dopey to me because they took the people who really bombed out in stuff like Windows Mobile and Bing and put them in charge of what are currently really successful products. We'll see how that goes.
I don't think you can blame people on that. A lot of those fights are losing battles.
Well, I mean, the
uphill battles.
The joke about Microsoft has always been that each division is out to destroy the other. Like, it's seven different companies that all work inside one big company, and they're all out to destroy each other and absorb the best people and stuff. The XKCD joke of the Microsoft org chart with the different divisions all pointing guns at each other seems pretty true from the people I've talked to in the past.
If I was now working on Windows Phone or Bing or something and was expected to be all of a sudden profitable, I would be, or Office even, I would be a little...
Well, Office is super profitable.
It is, but it feels like a product that is becoming less and less relevant every year.
That is the perception from here. I think they would probably tell you they're still making a shitload of money.
I'm probably too isolated from the business world that buys 500, you know, licenses of Office or whatever. But I feel like Google Docs is so easily just
supplanted. Office 365 is for
supplanted what people need for.
We've had this conversation on the podcast before, and we get eaten alive for it every time. So I'm going to just send you out to the wolves.
Fair
Wesley
enough.
Fenlon believes that Microsoft Office is no longer relevant in a post Google Docs world. No, I mean, the point is, for people like us who just do light word processing stuff, you don't need a $100 copy of Office anymore.
Obviously, Excel way more powerful than
and a lot of people really love Outlook because they have some sort of problem.
But the point is, especially like for Windows Phone, it's got to...
I mean, Windows Mail.
No, Outlook.
.com?
Outlook, Windows Mail is Office. In Office, there's still a program called Outlook.
Oh,
I mean the client Outlook for mail reading, yes. Exchange is the server side of that. And Outlook.com, apparently spammers love, because I get a lot of spam from Outlook.com addresses. Sorry, Wes.
But yeah, poor Windows Phone.
Poor Windows Phone.
Having to make money. It's a scary place to be.
Well, and also, like, the update cycle on Windows Phone has been kind of grim. And if now the people that were in charge, like, that is all rolled up under the same thing, under the same person. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Windows updates. And are we going to still see annual Xbox updates? Is it going to be more of a rolling cycle? What's the strategy for this stuff going forward? Because Microsoft at Build pretty much promised a faster Windows update cycle. We'll see how this goes. It's a dramatic, it seems like a dramatic change from the outside. I don't know if there are people who work at Microsoft and want to chime in on how it feels from the inside. I'd love to hear.
Speaking of, there's a new Windows Phone on the block as of today,
mm-hmm. Has
been announced.
Amazing segue, Wes.
Thank you, Will.
Nicely done.
Then we just put a quick post up on the site, but it's the Lumia 1020.
Yeah,
and
so it's a Nokia phone.
They went over 1,000.
Just
by 20.
4.5-inch screen. I think it's AMOLED. It's like a 1280 by 768 screen, so pretty standard. It's like a dual-core Snapdragon.
Okay.
Kind of internally all the same stuff you would expect from kind of any...
Now, what's important to me...
Any average smartphone these days. Yeah.
What is important to you, Norman?
Is this is still shiny plastic, or is it matte polycarbonate?
It's the polycarbonate.
It's all polycarbonate, yeah, but is it the shiny, glossy version? Or is it the matte version?
I think it's the exact same as the 920.
It's the star shiny version.
Yeah. So the 925 was, they switched to aluminum, right?
Yeah.
For that one.
And 925 is on T-Mobile.
You can upgrade that 6 months after you get it if you turn it out you don't like Windows Phone.
But the big new thing with the 1020 is they brought the 41 megapixel camera sensor over from the last Symbian phone they put out last February.
They call this like megapixel or micro super.
It's called PureView, that's it. The branding. But yeah, really high resolution camera. It sticks out of the back of the phone.
Now, this larger sensor, high megapixel camera, doesn't actually save 41 megapixel images.
It does shoot 7,000 by 5,000.
It saves by 7,000?
Yep.
That is too many.
Actually, it might be down to like 38 megapixels or something. Just
the 808.
The cropping. But
808 does save 5 megapixel.
Well, I think I'm pretty sure the 808 could shoot the higher res. I'm not positive if it could, but I think it could. But this one, the way it works is you save a super high res 40 megapixel photo, and then also you can optionally take 5 megapixel pictures that are just super oversampled, so they look at 100 pixels and turn that into 1 pixel.
So basically it works like anti-aliasing or something like that does on a PC game. So that's the benefit, is that you get much clearer, better images than you should given the size of the optics of the camera?
And that you basically get zoom, in that you can zoom in on an image
digital zoom
video.
Doesn't suck.
Right, your digital zoom is not...
It's still technically digital zoom, you're just cropping.
Sure.
I would assume you also have crazy image stabilization on the video because you have a much bigger field of vision.
And manual focus.
And can you shoot higher frame rate with this?
I know it can shoot 1080p 30.
Okay.
I don't know if it can go any higher than that. It might do like something at 60.
Crazy if you could do like 1,000 frames a second at 240p. It's get bananas.
Probably not going to happen.
Get a GoPro.
So what's the phone like? I love the idea of a nice camera and a phone, like a real camera and a phone, but also I'm not going to buy a crap phone to do that. What's the phone inside the camera?
The processor?
Like, what is it? Is it equivalent to one of the current Lumias, or is it
a
new
Snapdragon 1.5 gigahertz, same as the 920, I believe.
Okay.
So it is not a especially new processor. It's not a bad processor.
It's an old phone with a new camera.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it costs $300.
How big is the
on contract?
Wow, that's bananas for a Windows phone. How big is the camera that hangs out? How much does it poke out the back? Is it like the little bump on the back of an HTC One?
Bigger than that.
Okay.
It is a bump, except the circumference of the bump is 4 times the size.
And it's a 6-element Zeiss lens.
Yep.
Okay. Interesting. I'm. Which carriers are going to get that? Did they announce in the U.S. yet?
Just AT&T.
Great.
I mean, they didn't like make a big deal of that being exclusive, so it could be something that changes, but I feel like right now...
It'll be GSM, probably.
I mean, AT&T is kind of Windows Phone, right?
Yeah.
Like, are they even on Verizon at all?
I don't have any idea. I haven't been keeping up with Windows Phone.
I think they are
very... shocking, I know.
They are very limited in scope outside of AT&T.
Well, the Nokia phones especially are GSM because they're, they're a GSM provider.
So you can get one on T-Mobile and AT&T, and beyond that, you're kind of out of luck.
The last piece of news is a human-powered helicopter. The Sikorsky Prize, which has been around for 33 years now. It was originally launched in 1980. It's $250,000 to the first people who can take off a certain amount of height, keep the helicopter flying within a 1-foot area hovering, and then land safely, all on human power, have finally, somebody's claimed the prize. It was a team built a helicopter called the Atlas, and it's a dude in a bicycle. It's 33 feet across. It's enormous and terrifying looking.
We did a post on the site about this a month ago, two months ago.
I think it was before the results were certified or something.
Not too long ago.
Yeah, it's really neat. But the results were certified, and I guess they claimed the prize. I think it was a couple of guys. Part of it was funded on Kickstarter. I know Jamie was involved with either this team or the other team in some way. And yeah, I think it's really cool. You should watch the video. Congratulations. It's
very
tiring. University of Toronto.
It's a really amazing looking contraption because you would kind of think it would be easier to lift something small off the ground, but the reality is the complete opposite, and it's just this lattice work of super lightweight piping going out to blades that are all powered by people on, you know, bicycle wheels, like just working their ass
like
off.
Crazy
to
gearing
lift right off the
to get these enormous fans going.
High torque.
Yeah.
Not something you would want to take a cruise in, but it's pretty cool.
It's the kind of thing that you look at it and you think, oh, that's not too hard. And then you start doing it and you're sweating and dying within 45 seconds.
Fly across the English Channel using human powered flight? Like,
but that was with a wing. A wing is a different story.
Yes, with the wing, but like even that was terrifying, and I think he almost didn't make it.
It reminds me of those old videos where people would, you would see like the crazy, you know, planes that have like 12 layers of levels of wings, and then they ride it off the edge over the water and just flop right in.
Yeah. Yeah,
the Red Bull event.
It's like that, but it works.
This thing looks like a Da Vinci device. Like it's so light and strutty and neat looking. It looks like something like from a Da Vinci sketch. By the way, Verizon does have Lumia, have Windows phones. They sell the Samsung Odyssey, the Lumia 928, and the HTC Windows Phone 8X.
I think that was
an A22.
I think that was actually kind of a big deal in the past year that they finally came to Verizon.
I feel like
maybe it was more than a year ago.
Yeah,
I don't remember.
It was a while ago.
There was a time when you could not get a Windows Phone.
Imagine a world, Wesley.
Pre-Verizon Windows phones. Who would want to live in that world?
Imagine a world. Should we talk about what we've been testing? Is there anything else newsy we want to talk about?
Nope. Play the segment. Do it.
Hey, Norman Chan.
Hey, Will Smith.
What have you been testing?
I got two things in front of me right now that are in the queue that we are testing right now to be reviewed, hopefully in the near future after Comic-Con. One is the Lenovo Yoga 11S that Wes alluded to earlier. I'm using it right now in the, I'm not sure which yoga position it is.
It looks like a downward facing dog to me.
Nah, more like a backbreaker or something.
A tiger claw.
Like if you think of a laptop and you fold it all the way back and the hinge flips all around, it's kind of like breaking your back.
So you're saying it's the backbreaker.
That's what I'm sticking to. It's the version, the mode where the keyboard faces the table. It's recessed. The keys are recessed. You're not pushing it. And you're kind of, it kind of works as a stand, so you can use Windows with your fingers. I like the 11S. There are three things right now that I am disappointed by. One is the brightness of the screen. While it is a nice IPS screen, and I think that objectively the colors look better on the screen than on, for example, the MacBook Air, which has the same 1366x768 resolution, I think the brightness is way too low on the Lenovo. The second thing is it is Ivy Bridge, not Haswell, and that just means performance is not as good as it could be in terms of battery life. Battery life is not bad. It's been getting consistently 5 hours of battery life for me. It's not 9. And the last thing I don't like about it, or that I wish was different, was that it runs Windows 8.
So you wish it had something that wasn't touch-enabled?
I wish Windows 8 was better. I like touch-enabled stuff. I just wish Windows 8 was better.
Fair enough. Have you put 8.1 on it yet?
Or no, I'm not putting it
because you're doing the review. You know, we've forgotten the news. The Steam sale is going on now. The Steam sale has started.
Video games.
Video game. Wait, that's somebody else.
With Steam cards now.
Yeah.
You can only get the exclusive summer sale Steam cards by buying games during the sale.
Fuck, that's so lame.
Which you can then turn into badges, which to my knowledge do nothing other
Steam
than
account hats.
Look cool. Or you can sell them back on the market and make some money back.
Is Spelunky out for Steam yet?
Next month. It is a month from July 4th, I think.
So that would be August 4th?
They announced, I believe it was on July 4th, they said coming out
a month
from now. It could have been like the 6th or something, but it's sometime early August.
The other thing I'm testing, which is technically my only second day of testing this, is the HTC One Google Edition.
Yeah. That's the next. That's the new Nexus. It's one of the new Nexi.
Well, you can't technically call it Nexus because neither the HTC One or Google Edition or the Samsung Galaxy S4 run pure Android 4.2.2. There's still other software. So far, I love it. I don't have my iPhone today. This is my SIM card.
Really, you're going? Wow.
iPhone's on airplane mode, stuck in a plugged in at home.
Wow.
And this is on. It's a big phone.
It is a mighty phone. I can't help but notice you're wearing your baggy jeans today, Norm.
It is definitely a phone that you cannot swipe down, at least with my hands, the notification bar if you're holding the bottom of the phone like I usually do, like my easel position.
Yep.
The screen is great. I was skeptical about 1080p screens, but photos on this and wallpaper photos as wallpapers look incredible. LTE is fast, and so far, it's getting accustomed to Android again.
Wesley Fenlon?
Yes.
You have been learning about scanlines.
I've learned so much about scanlines.
Explain scanlines.
Tell me everything.
How did they work?
So, really, scanlines are like, I put up a big post on the site today about CRT technology and people who kind of obsessively try to get the best possible video gear for old game consoles. And scanlines are only a very small part of that. They're probably the part that people most closely associate with old games because it's really striking, right? If you look at the difference between an emulated game or just something running on a modern HD display with no scanlines versus the scanlines, like how much darker it makes the image, how much it can kind of cut down on like the sharpness of the pixels. It's like it is something that we really strongly associate with arcades and what those games should look like.
So NES and SNES and Genesis and probably N64
and PS1
games have scanlines because they only sent it. Well, analog TVs, CRTs used interlaced signals. So they sent one set of lines, the even lines, and then they sent the odd lines.
Right.
Arcade, the early consoles only sent one set.
Why did they do that?
Right?
It was because of the CRT, the electron meter?
Probably could have been because of, I actually don't know why that was the case.
I think it was just
probably a vestige of the TV transmission.
That was how they transmitted the signal. And I think it was partially for that content, speed wasn't as big a deal, right? Like you were getting more lines of signal, you're getting a higher quality image, and you didn't need to see the newscast at the highest possible frame rate. Right?
It wasn't until they started broadcasting tennis that it became a problem.
Right. So like when, you know, the big deal with everybody who plays games prefers a progressive signal because you care about that higher quality, higher speed signal when you're playing a fighting game.
You don't want the comb effect.
Exactly.
So they only sent one set of lines.
Consoles did not do that.
They only sent either the even or the odd, and the others were just black.
Yep.
So that's why things look interlaced. And is it the same thing for arcades?
Yeah. Okay. And there were some differences with arcade monitors. Like there were higher resolution ones. These, like one of the key bits of terminology for old, people refer to it as 240p because that's how many progressive lines there were. But they also interchangeably use 15 kilohertz to refer to the old consoles as well, the video output they did, because there are literally like 1,575 refreshes a second of those lines.
15,000 kilohertz.
15,000, yeah.
Okay.
And so anyway, a lot of times we refer to...
You sure it's not 15 hertz?
I believe it's 15 kilohertz.
It's kilohertz. It's over 15,000.
So it's 15...
We're talking about horizontal resolution, which is very different than...
Oh,
the
so the
not
horizontal pixels are refreshing
right.
that many. Okay, get it.
Because it's every line.
It's all the
30
pixels.
Times per second.
Got it. Yeah. Okay.
So we kind of colloquially refer to scan lines as those black lines in the image,
detail.
Right? But those are just empty lines.
Yeah.
There's not actually anything there. And the real scan lines are the colored lines where the electron gun is actually lighting up these phosphors, you know, row by row by row. So people really care about scan lines, and there are basically two different ways you can can get those for your old games. One is to play on a CRT, and two is to play on a modern display using either software emulation or hardware emulation to mimic that effect. So the story I did last year about BSNES, one of the things I mentioned is there are like shaders now and filters where you can just load up an emulator and then just plop some fake scan lines on top of that.
So basically you run up like a little program on your video card that modifies the output before it gets to the screen to make it look right.
Yeah, so there's a program, I think it's called SweetFX. I didn't actually write about that, but you can use that for, I think, kind of any game that you play. And then there are built-in options and like plugins for emulators, like BSNES just has a shaders like folder that you can throw scripts in. And that's how you add shaders to those games. And they also have other things to like try to mimic the NTSC color palette, which looks different than your monitor would normally look. Because obviously CRTs made in the early 90s had a very different color tone than,
of course,
than LCDs do. So that's how you do that with emulation. But the other end of that is on the hardware side, you can buy an image processor to basically take a signal from your Super Nintendo, your Genesis, whatever your console that you're trying to play with, and plug it into that image processor and then output from that to an HDTV. And there are a couple benefits there. One is a lot of them let you add scan lines in. And they're actually, so the main one I wrote about is called the XRGB Mini, and it lets you customize the weight, basically, of the scan lines you output. So you can have really, really heavy black scan lines. You can kind of do lighter ones, you know, based on your preferences.
But what's the primary function of these devices?
So the scan lines are kind of just the added bonus. Yeah. And the main reason to use them is to take your 240p signal and output that to something that a modern display can run well. So the big issue with playing games, old games on an LCD, is they look like total shit, and usually the input lag is pretty bad. And that's, as was explained to me by the guy who runs this awesome site, it's called hazardcity.de with a dash in it. His name's Tobias. He goes by Fudo online, and he's written about, I'm going to say 40,000 words over the past 5 years explaining how all these image processors work. And he's tested like dozens of them. So I got in contact with him and interviewed him about the technology. And the reason there's really bad input lag on LCDs and like sometimes colors don't look right is that they handle a progressive signal from an old console as though it was an interlaced signal, basically. They don't know how to take that low-res signal.
And so they don't add the empty lines.
Right. Well, they don't add the empty lines for scan lines, but they don't know how to process the input properly. So they try to deinterlace it.
And this is also why when you plug in a SNES into like a Hophog HD PVR or something like that, it just doesn't know what to do with the capture and can't capture it.
I'm guessing it's kind of the same thing. Okay. So if you plug your Super Nintendo into your Samsung or whoever, like your Plasma, it's going to try to deinterlace that low-res signal, and it will eventually output something, but with like 2 or 3 frames or more of input lag on it because it is a progressive signal. It does not need to be deinterlaced, but it's just going through the exact same...
The TV is too dumb, too smart to know what to do with a dumb signal.
Exactly.
Basically.
So it's going through the exact same processing routines that any input would go through, any like 480i input would go through, and it comes out kind of a mess.
Okay.
And you don't get your scan lines. So there are all these different image processors that are actually mostly designed for like 480i signals or 480p signals, but they just happen to work basically with these low-res 240p signals that you get from a Super Nintendo, a Sega Genesis, a PS1, blah, blah, blah. So you can plug them into an image processor,
uh-huh,
and it will do its own processing and output a progressive signal to the TV that the TV understands.
Thinks it's a 720p or 1080p HD signal.
Okay.
And so then so even though you are adding in some input lag from that image processor, you're not getting any from your TV. So your net result is a much faster processing of that image and a much better processing of that image.
Huh.
And these devices, the one you talked about, the one people recommend, are about $400 made in Japan only.
Yeah, and there are tons and tons of different kinds, but kind of the community choice right now is the XRGB Mini Framemeister, which is about $400. And you can input a variety. You need tons of adapters for all of these different things. So just one crazy example is RGB is kind of the go-to best quality signal because you have separate red,
that's
green, blue
component
channels. Yeah, there's a difference, but quality-wise, they're extremely similar.
Okay.
But so like with the Super Nintendo, for example, you can get a RGB SCART cable, which is what they use in Europe.
Yeah.
Or you can get an RGB SCART cable that they use in Japan. And even though the input end that plugs into the Super Nintendo is the same and the output end, the SCART end, looks the same, they're pinned differently. So if you use the wrong one on...
your luminance or chroma or something's all jacked up?
Or you'll just break your image processor.
Awesome.
Depending on, like... so you need the proper adapter for the Japanese one versus the...
Jesus.
The European one. People do tons of cable modding where they basically make their own cables for these systems to get an RGB signal they can output. But it's kind of a hobbyist thing, right?
Like, yeah.
This is not easy. And if you wanted a good enough picture, you know, you could just get like, just be happy with your laggy modern display or buy a CRT and just output S-video to it and kind of call it a day.
Well, and just to be clear, like the $400 for something like that sounds kind of expensive until you understand like how expensive it is to capture, like to capture video off of old consoles. I know that
people are using this just to play the games.
No, I know. I understand that. But I'm saying like to do the capture stuff, the expensive thing isn't the capture. It's getting the thing that can convert the 240p into 480i or 480p, which is something that everything understands.
Exactly.
And the thing that Vinny uses over at Giant Bomb to do that with SNES games was like $7,000 or $8,000.
Yeah,
like, so they're crazy expensive.
Yeah, so he just tweeted at me a bit earlier about the Image Pro HD 2, I think, was what they used.
Yeah.
I might have gotten the name wrong.
And it took him a long time to find that, as I recall.
And I looked it up online and like saw one site that listed the MSRP of that as at $12,000. Mm-hmm. And it has way more inputs. I'm sure it is a much better piece of kit than like the XRGB Mini is. But the fact that you can buy the Mini for $400 and use it, and it's, you know, it's not the absolute perfect way to play old games, but you're like 98% of the
good,
way there.
Good enough for most people.
And that is what, plenty good enough for most people.
Yeah.
But that is kind of the ultimate hobbyist way to play old consoles on new displays, and it comes really, really close to playing those games on the best CRT you could possibly ever buy.
Cool.
And I wrote a bunch about that CRT too, but kind of the area where this gets fun is thinking about like the nostalgia we have for old games and how they should look versus the quality of these displays, and how like the CRT I mentioned in the story is this old production monitor that cost $10,000 when it came out in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Looks so much better than the TV any of us ever had at home.
But it's how we want to remember it.
It's how you want to remember it, but like if you look at your old TV, like you're gonna have color shifting going on and blooming and all this stuff, and like this display doesn't do any of that.
When you say production monitor, you mean a monitor used to
in NBC control room?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I used to play NES games on a 13-inch, I think, RCA, like a portable TV. It had a handle on the top. And the main power that came into the house was just on the other side of the wall.
So you got like flickering?
So it was always like gnarly flickering, like weird colors on the edges. And I just thought games looked bad until I went to college, like literally until I went to college or something like that. And I was like, oh shit, this is my, huh.
I mean, and tons of us
TV
would play,
sucked ass.
We would use like an RF adapter into the TV, and like, you know, that's the bottom of the barrel in terms of image quality.
Well, that's all that most TVs had
in
the back in the day.
Yeah, when you had a composite input, that was money.
Yeah. For a long time, I looked at that little composite plug in the back of the NES and was like, what the hell is this thing? Actually, I guess it wasn't
yellow.
Even composite. It was the original ones didn't
RCA.
Have a RCA plug, did it? It was two audios.
I don't think the NES did, but I might be wrong.
Maybe you had to get a dongle.
Since the Super Nintendo, they used their multi-AV out. I forget what the NES had, but
yeah. Anyway, so that I thought was a fascinating story and is definitely worth reading if you're into that stuff. Even if you're not going to go back and play old NES games, it was a very informative story.
And there's hundreds of thousands of more words on the subject if you are into it and start checking out these forums and
if you want to dig deep.
Yeah. Guys are super passionate about it, and I think it's a cool hobby.
So I talked about ordering a mattress on the internet a few weeks ago. It has been an interesting experience. So I bought one of the Dream Foam mattresses from Amazon after going out and looking at fancy mattresses at the mattress showcase, and I was like, fuck this, I'm not paying $4,000 for a mattress.
Showroom that shit.
Mattress.
Well, you didn't because you bought something that's
I bought something that's not available. It's only available on the internet. I was like, let's try the internet because worst case, I'm out $600 if this goes badly. And I think all in, I actually ended up getting the upgraded one, which is the memory foam with the air channels and all that shit on the top, not just the pure latex mattress. The mattress came. It was all rolled up into about a 1-foot by 1-foot tube, and it weighed about 100 pounds. And you rolled that out, and we left it on the floor of the living room for a couple of days so it could kind of air out and get the chemical stink out of it. You did the same thing, Wes, right?
I did, except that, well, I slept on it like that night because literally when I moved to San Francisco, I ordered like some basic furniture to arrive the same day.
Yeah.
It smelled for a couple days, but it wasn't like paint bad.
Once
right?
The bearing damage stopped, you've been okay.
Yeah, I'm perfectly fine.
So I really like the mattress. I am a fan. The memory foam I'm totally down with. It gets a little bit warm. Especially since we've had the kind of heat wave that we've had lately.
What kind of sheets are you using, too?
Well, we had flannel on for a while because we live in Pacifica and it's cold as shit all the time.
Okay.
But we put the normal, like, cotton, percale, whatever.
Because if you're hot and you're using flannel sheets, clearly...
I don't ever get hot.
Yeah, you are.
I'm never hot.
The only one to blame.
Yeah. The thing that I've found about it that's a little uncomfortable is, like, when you sink into the memory foam, because what happens is as your body heat warms the memory foam, it becomes more compressible, and then it kind of forms, like, a perfect ass groove for you so that like your ass sinks down deeper than your legs and your back and like the heaviest parts of you sink lower and you end up with good support across the whole thing, which it's fantastic. The downside of it is that those crevasses, things get a little damp, like not damp, but sweaty. It's not ideal. And the more expensive mattresses, like your Tempur-Pedics and all that stuff, have fancy cooling channels and stuff like that. That I feel like this mattress probably doesn't have because it was $800 or $750 or something. However, when compared to spending $700, it's very soft compared to a traditional spring-wrapped mattress, which I have not experienced before. Like you kind of push down into it and you sink down into it a little bit. But once you distribute your weight out across the whole thing, it feels very analogous to a regular mattress. I feel like I got my $800 worth out of it. I feel like this is going to carry me through until we can afford a house that will fit a king size bed in the master bedroom, and then we'll spend money on a fancy mattress.
What's the right price to pay for a pillow? The perfect pillow.
Do you like down pillows, or do you want like filled with tears and sadness?
No, down pillows. Soft, something soft.
I have paid between $50 and $150 for down pillows before.
That's expensive. That.
Well, it depends on whether you like getting jabbed in the back of the neck with little pieces of feather.
Oh, maybe not down pillows.
Okay. I bought Tempur-Pedic pillows, which I fucking hated.
Why?
They don't compress. They're not really pillows. They're just more like a wedge of foam.
Yeah. But is that better for you?
I have seen
it's
those.
Supposed to be better for your back, but I couldn't. Like, I use it as the bottom pillow now. It, like, props up the other pillows. I like to sit in bed and read, so I like to prop up a little bit before I go to sleep, and then I throw the pillows down at the foot of the bed. A good down pillow is really expensive because good down is expensive.
And they don't last that long, right?
I usually 4 or 5 years, maybe a little longer.
That's pretty long time. I was thinking, wow.
Yeah, I can start a subscription service. You can upgrade down pillows twice a year, pay $5 a month.
There you go.
Insurance too.
I believe the Sweet Home is currently testing best pillows.
I'm waiting for them to do smoke detectors. Smoke detectors are really hard. You probably have the contractor ones in your house because,
absolutely.
Yeah, but
some sell plastic covering over them. I'm kidding.
That's, you know, if it starts making annoying beeping noise, you can just take the battery out.
That's right.
Do you like does yours ever go off?
Oh yes. Well,
when you're cooking and stuff from like steam?
No, from smoke.
Okay. Ours go off from steam, which is the most maddening thing in the world.
Ours are networked,
Oh, great. That's awesome.
So when one goes off.
Oh, they do all go off.
I'm pretty sure they're networked, or because I can't think of any other way that
it could be like a radio or something, but I guess that's still a network.
Sure. Yep.
They are connected in some way, so they all go off.
So there's one kind of near the kitchen, and that one will go off if somebody's like cooking a steak or something and they don't have the vent on. And then there's one upstairs where the air will kind of go up and sit just. And,
at the top of the stairwell?
Yeah, and so once they go off, it's usually like a 3 or 4 minute process of, you know, you're trying to get the air out, and maybe you clear everything else, but that one is just still like, I smell smoke, guys. I'm going.
and of course, they're networked, but they're networked in the dumb way. So if you hit the snooze button on one, but you have to go hit each one individually, there's probably one in each of the bedrooms, right? San Francisco code says there's one in each of the bedrooms.
There is probably,
yeah. So that's a real bummer. It's the worst usability. Like, I'm totally like, I want smoke detectors to be safe, but I also want them to be smart enough that if it goes off and it's something that is not a fire, I should be able to hit a button and it will ignore that shit until such a time as there is an actual fire.
I just want
and none of them work well.
I just want fire alarms to let me burn myself to death if I want to.
Man, freedom ain't free, Wes. Let's see, other stuff I've been testing. Smarter Things, which was the Kevin Rose backed or endorsed, maybe, basically Z-Wave, Zigbee, home automation controller, super hub. Because I don't know if you've ever used any of that home automation stuff before, but it kind of routinely sucks because the people making the software for the controllers, like the switches and stuff are all fine, but the thing that controls the switches are usually really stupid. So you have like this weird 500 button remote control that you have to program in the most esoteric way imaginable to make lights turn on and off as you'd expect. And these guys said, look, we can do all this with Wi-Fi and Zigbee and Z-Wave and phone apps.
It's a coming of age ritual.
Ugh. So I've been testing that stuff for the last month or so. And it is interesting, but not like it's still not. It's much better than it's ever been before because I did it, used some of it back in the X10 days. But it is still not very good.
So what are you automating?
Lights mostly so far. So I put a sensor on the door that detects when the front door opens and closes. It also detects temperature in that room and I think motion on the sensor itself. And that's powered by like a 1-year lithium battery, like one of those big fat kind of A-looking batteries, but it's lithium ion, so it lasts a really long time. There's a couple of fobs that are like presence detectors. So they, when they're within range of the hub, they turn on and let the hub know that you're home. You can also do that with the app on the phone itself. So when you get within a certain geofence, it'll trigger and say, "Hey, Will's home." And then you can write these little scripts. They call them apps, but they're basically little scripts that say, "Okay, when both Will and Gina are at home, then do this." And this can be turn on the lights, turn off the lights, turn on the air conditioning, and it ties into everything, including lighting, Zigbee stuff, Z-Wave stuff, and even like if TTT and stuff like that. So you can do like it seems really like a really neat idea. And then when you actually start using it, it's always a pain in the ass.
You never do not need that level of home automation.
Well,
turn on the light yourself.
It was nice.
Like I do not. I was like, we turn off computers when we leave the house.
That's good policy.
And then as I was driving home, I was like, I wish there was a system that knew when I was, 3 minutes away from the house that would automatically turn on my computer.
That's exactly what this is.
And you know what? I can wait 3 minutes, go home, and turn on the computer. I do not need an elaborate system to do that.
Here's the thing. When you have the kid and you don't have hands, it's nice to walk in the living room and the lights turn on. But sometimes you walk in the living room and you don't want the lights to turn on. And the only way to tell it not to do that is to open up the phone and do the app and all this stuff. So it ends up being much more of a pain in the ass than or alternately, I'm bad at programming it. Either of these things are possible. I don't know. I'm still fucking around with it. But I need to replace all of the light switches in my house with Z-Wave light switches, which is at about $40 or $50 a pop, gets kind of expensive. And like, I don't know if it's worth that. It's nice. It is nice in the one room that I put a Z-Wave light switch in by accident a few years ago that like I went to the store and I was like, I want the kind of dimmer that you tap and it goes up and you could stop anywhere along the way. And I bought one. And I was like, this is really expensive for a dimmer, but whatever. And it turned out to be a Z-Wave switch. That was nice. The neat thing you can do is set all of the lamps and stuff in a room to be tied to a switch. So you can tap a button on a Z-Wave switch and it will turn up turn on all the lamps in the room at the same time, so you can have like grown up lighting in a room without having and still have without having to have controlled receptacles, because that's the way you would do that typically is control all the receptacles off of that switch, and that's a huge pain in the ass to wire if it's not already wired that way.
That's kind of nice too for houses or places that have light switches in random ass places.
Yeah.
Like my family's lake house has about 5 different walls / like under like not
it's
under
like
cabins,
inside
but
bookshelves or
exactly,
yeah
they're just. It's like a big open room, and there are light switches on all the walls everywhere. Yeah. And it's like trying to find the right switch to control the right light is just I've been going there forever, and I can't remember where they are.
Well, the nice thing about this is it also allows you to deforce the switches from the actual wiring. So if you put if you put like Philips Hue bulbs in your lights, then you can control them with the Z-Wave switches. And that, like, you can have a Z-Wave switch in a wall that just has a 1-year battery in it, and it's not connected to the power grid at all. Like, it's not wired into your home's electrical system. It's just a dummy box on the wall that looks like a real light switch and behaves like a real light switch, except for it controls something using your network.
I mean, this is where...
Which is neat.
We could use something like, you know, the next generation Kinect or some type of room mapping technology where and maybe eye-tracking technology where it knows what lights you're looking at, and then you give it a gesture... And you like point at it, and then it turns on.
But at that point, wouldn't it just be easier to have a clapper and
clap that clapper, on? You want something silent, and you want something that when you walk into a room, you look at the lights because you want to see where the light is. And then if you look at the lights and blink twice, Google Glass it.
There you go.
Give it a pew pew, and then it'll turn on.
That's exactly it. Speaking of Google Glass, my glass is broken. We talked about this last week when they announced the XE7 update. I have no idea. It just like the update stalled or got stuck or something. So I'm taking it back into Google later this afternoon, and they're going to give me a new set. They were very nice.
Can you change your color?
I don't know. I was thinking about it.
You should change your color.
You don't think I should do orange?
If you have the opportunity to have two colors without having to pay for two Google glasses,
that's true.
Why would you not?
But I don't know which. I guess I'd go with blue.
Yeah, there you go.
What are the options?
Gray, black, blue, white, and orange. I really like the orange though.
Should be a purple.
No purple.
Get the blue.
I'll see. I'll see if they'll let me change them.
I mean, they're going to let you give me a new pair, theoretically. Yes. Yeah, then they will let you
change them. They don't have them like pre-allotted or whatever, because it took a while for the appointment to hit. Do we want to talk about Last of Us?
No.
I feel like...
We have not played it.
Oh, you have not played it. We have to talk about Last of Us, because I've talked a rasher of shit about Uncharted games on this show in the past. And
just say you like it.
It's really good. Okay. They fixed all of the problems that I had with the bad combat in the previous Uncharted games.
I mean, the whole game is about a story and combat.
It is a
new way.
A moving and unique video game experience, and people should play it if they
can't have PlayStations. Can't wait to play it.
You can't wait to watch it.
Can't wait to watch Wes play it.
That is Gina watched me play this game, and usually when she watches me play games, she like laughs at the bad dialogue along the way, and there was none of that. Like, sound design is really good. It's really a tight game. Like,
it is Naughty Dog's, you know, 6 years of this console generation.
Yeah,
technology and technique build up.
But more than the tech stuff, like the actual mechanics, the mechanic of the way they handle stealth in this game is novel in my experience of stealth games. In that there's no kind of alarm state, so you don't feel like you've failed if you're detected. And most of the stealth sequences seem to be based around the idea that you kind of use stealth to set up success in the action bit, because the action is almost always unavoidable. Or if you're going to have fun playing the game, you're going to end up fighting a little bit, but you want to kind of thin the herd with stealth before you have to start beating people up with bricks.
You've said too much already.
Yeah, it's really good. You should play it. You want to take some questions?
Yeah, let's do that.
Have you played Rogue Legacy, Wes?
I haven't. Should I play
Rogue Legacy
stuff,
too?
Yeah,
it's really good.
Oh, wait. Emails? Well, but we do the other one.
Emails.
Yeah, we don't do emails, we do...
Emails?
No.
Questions.
Boom.
If you have a question for This Only Test, the email address is podcast@tested.com.
Norm seems really confused.
That
right
was
now.
A weird cue. Did you press two at once?
I hit two buttons at once.
Good thing they were the same length.
Thanks for calling it out, though.
Questions?
It was weird. Yeah,
if you have questions
for This Is Only Test, the email address is podcast@tested.com. We like written questions and audio questions. If you have audio questions, we'll probably play them before we'll take the written question, unless we just don't want to answer your question because we're dicks. Here is the first question. It is from Ian from Newfoundland. I need a camera for beginners. My main camera as of now is sadly my iPhone 5, and I'm looking for a serious upgrade. I was looking at the NEX 5N or 5R online and decided to go to the local Best Buy to see what was up with it. What I found was the 5R for $650, which I thought was a fair price, and some full DSLRs for as low as $500. Am I better off starting with an entry-level DSLR or spending slightly more on a more expensive mirrorless camera? This seems like a norm question.
The answer is neither, and it's get a cheaper mirrorless camera like the older 5N, which you can get for under $500, or even the F3, which I believe you can get as low as $375.
And that comes with the 1855 kit lens?
Yeah. If you're just starting, don't spend more than $600.
So the only reason you'd spend it on a DSLR is if you think you're going to really invest heavily and buy into the lens ecosystem.
And if you're even thinking about price, that means you're not ready to buy $1,000 lenses. You don't need to worry about that stuff. And you shouldn't.
Adele asks, I was just thinking about getting an iPad mini, but was wondering if it would be better to wait for them to update it with its sequel before I jumped in. I have a Kindle Fire HD 8.5 right now. Do you think Apple will update the mini sooner rather than later?
Yes.
Yes. The answer is yes.
September.
The answer is wait.
Because it's going to be 2 months, right?
It will be for a holiday. The mini will be...
could be October. But...
Yeah, I mean, we're mid-year predictions, cheaper iPhone, higher-end iPhone, iPad mini. Those are the three big products, iOS products, coming out later this year. Because we've seen all the new Mac products.
Mackenzie asks, I'm looking at buying a good microphone mainly for podcasting, but I also want something I can use with my DSLR. Most DSLR mics I've seen, such as the Rode video mic, are directional shotgun mics. Would those be good for podcasting? Shotgun mics are probably not real good for podcasting. What a lot of people I know who do podcasting, DSLR audio is use something like the Zoom H4N, which is a, basically, it's like a little studio. It's a field recorder is what it's called. It has XLR inputs, so you can plug a shotgun mic into it that you then hook on your DSLR. It also has a couple of pretty good directional mics that stick off of it. I think Patrick over at Giant Bomb has been using it for the interview dump truck lately. It's kind of expensive. It may be more than you want to spend. But you can also look for an XLR-based. If you want to use something for both podcasting and for DSLR, you're going to want XLR inputs, and you're going to want to have two different microphones, one that's a shotgun mic, and then one like the ones that we use for the podcast, which are Audio-Technica AT2035s, which are cardioid unidirectional mics. They have kind of a – basically, the field of good sound pickup on them looks like a chat bubble on a comic. So it's like a – there's like a point – that's dead around the edges of the microphone, and then there's a big bubble, and your head can be anywhere inside that, and it sounds pretty good. And if you get outside that, it's gonna be bad. That's terrible for doing DSLR recording. And the shotgun is very unidirectional and will pick up sound from far away and kind of isolate the thing that you aim at. So if you just want a cheap microphone for podcasting and it's just gonna be you can get like a USB microphone, like a Blue Yeti or Snowball. They're $50 or $100 and sound great. But it's really hard to mix USB mics. So if you're going to have multiple people in the same room talking, you need to have something with XLRs and a mixer or a field recorder or something like that.
I really like the image of someone using a snowball with their DSLR to record video.
It's awful.
Can you just hold this?
Yeah,
hold
it's going to be right here. Just ignore it.
Don't look at the snowball.
It's shiny, I know, but don't look at the mic. That'll do it for questions. Podcast@tester.com is the email address. Let's see. We've got a ton of great stuff on the site this week. Norm, you and Adam built something fucking just awesome and amazing and radical and cool.
We built the Han Solo Blaster as a one-day build.
The Blastech DL-44.
DL-44. And had a lot of fun with it. Do another video with the weathering sometime in the indeterminate future.
Are you going to... So there's some... So you wrote a really great post a few months ago about like the history of recreating the DL-44.
The people on the Replica Prop Forum who dedicated two years of their life on top of research other people have done on finding what components went into this prop. And their story is very interesting. And they are super passionate and generous enough to share that information with the community. And then also... take it upon themselves to get these parts machined.
So they did a run, basically?
They've done two runs now, and they're not cheap, but for people who, and there are a lot of collectors out there. There's one guy in Sweden, I believe, who has, you know, dozens and dozens of guns from movies, and just it would put Adam's pistol collection to shame. And they want the best. They go for a certain type of authenticity, because there are many different kinds, and this is their passion project.
So, so you ordered, you took part in the run and collected the other stuff that you needed to put the
it's nowhere near as good as their assemblies, but it gives the greater audience a sense of what's out there and
just the barest surface
and the effort that goes into doing these type of things.
So when you weather it, what are you going to do? What's the plan?
There's a lot of the parts are aluminum, a lot of it's steel.
Okay.
And so there's different processes you can apply to those things.
So do you like get the aluminum stuff anodized, or
some of the aluminum's already anodized?
Okay.
Which is nice. There's be some paint. The steel need to be blued, which is a process of dipping it in certain types of chemicals to protect it, but gives it a nice color.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can buff that out and then do other stuff and
kind of scuff it up a little bit, like it's been on a smuggler's hip for the last 10 years.
There you go.
Very cool. It is a fantastic. It's gorgeous. Absolutely. I mean, I've seen it in person. You've posted some pictures of it. I know.
It is.
I can't imagine what one that looks better than that is, and I can't wait to see what happens when you weather it. So, other stuff on the site. We posted some Ask Jamie videos. People send questions for Jamie, and then we talk to him about the question and find out more about what makes the man tick. They've been good. I think we have four or five of them. Three. We'll have four up next week, I guess.
The third one goes up next week.
Okay. So third one next week. Keep an eye out for that. We're at Comic-Con all next week.
Yep.
I can't believe it's already that time of year again.
Yeah. We also have, some cool show and tell stuff, done. There's some stuff we bought at Maker Faire. Like it's finally getting assembled. One other project that has not been assembled yet, but we'll save for a future, show and tell video.
Ooh.
And
survival lantern coming up next week.
Arduino clocks and projects.
Yeah, Alex's thing about the timer. He built a chess timer out of an Arduino. Designed the board, the code's there, and everything. So if you want to do it yourself, you can. It's super cool.
And then Wes, you wrote something for the Wirecutter, which we posted about best USB key, which USB 3 key,
big ass thumb drive, Wes.
Fast thumb drive,
a fat thumb drive too.
Capacity wise.
Are you talking about?
I'm talking about physical size. It's enormous.
It's long, but in terms, it's not so wide that, like, I've actually had other ones that it's problematic when you're trying to plug in two drives with, like, USB ports that are nearby, and it's actually the width on us.
I mean, compared to those nano drives now, which are basically just the stub that you can throw on a keychain, yes, it is big, but I think USB keys like that I throw in my bag. And
it is basically a mini SSD.
Yeah, it has a controller of an SSD.
Yeah.
Which is incredible. Like, so, you're paying $45 for 32 gigs SSD storage, moving files at 200 megs.
Like there was another drive, there was a Lexar, I believe, that was also really good speed wise, but not as good. It was more compact, but it was significantly.
It also means that reliability is going to be pretty good on that in the long run.
Yeah.
So basically, when you're buying a USB drive, you're looking at either physical size or capacity and speed, transfer speed. And this seemed like this was much more focused on performance.
I mean, if you want like a 2 gig drive to like put a few documents on and you have that on your keychain and carry it around all the time, it kind of doesn't matter what you pick.
Pick the smallest thing.
If you want something, you just want something tiny, right? If you want a singular thumb drive that you are using to carry a bunch of stuff on, whatever you need it for, this drive is awesome.
Well, and we deal a lot with large files, whether it's an uncompressed 2-hour podcast, which is 2 to 4 gigs, or raw video, which can go up to 150, 100 to 200 gigs of uncompressed video.
Or photos.
Like, you don't want to be sitting around waiting for a slow-ass thumb drive.
Do you keep like your Dropbox, a copy of your Dropbox synchronized on that?
I don't.
I keep that to my server.
I mean, when I was testing, I was using different keys. I usually use them for transferring photos and videos.
So what's the on the like size on the capacity? I'm sorry, on the when we used to test thumb drives at Max PC, one of the things that we found is that drive controllers are tuned either for lots of small file transfers very quickly or transferring large files very quickly.
Yeah.
But there's kind of no happy medium, or there was no happy medium at the time. Is that still the case?
This one was good for both.
Okay.
But there were definitely big differences. I'm forgetting, Crystal Disk Mark, I think, was the name of the tool I used to benchmark it.
Okay.
And it shows you your different types of read and write speeds. And you have like your 4K, which is the small file test versus the like the lump or your that was for small files. And then you've got your bulk throughput. I forget the exact like terminology it used in the test. But some USB drives, and is the same with like SD cards, are really, really bad when it comes to those low, small.
And when we talk about small, you're talking about like 10 kilobyte files, tiny little files.
Yeah, and that kind of read and write speed is really critical if you want to like run Windows off a drive.
Right.
When you're just copying over a bunch of files, it's not as important, but you can still get a big difference between copying like a 5 gigabyte video versus 100 kilobyte files.
Right. Even though one is much smaller than the other capacity wise, it'll take a lot longer.
Right. This one is great for both.
How much does it cost?
The 32 gigabyte one is $45.
So it's expensive for a thumb drive, but not expensive. It's not for what you get.
For a USB 3 thumb drive, it's one of the cheapest out there and is the fastest.
It's always a good find, isn't
it? Yeah. And the prices like on Amazon always kind of fluctuate. I think at one point the 64 gigabyte one was like $65.
That's instant.
That's
buy.
Good. Yeah.
I think normally it's like 70 or something, but that's still like the bigger you go, the better price.
You're talking about something
that was
bigger than the capacity of what was in a MacBook Air 2 years ago, the base. Yeah. 64 gigs.
I still have a 128 megabyte thumb drive that I paid $40 for.
So then you can essentially, if you have like a netbook or an ultrabook with a relatively small SSD, you can plug this in and use it as secondary storage that you actually work off of. They're that fast.
Yeah, you can.
I would say if you are buying like an ultrabook, and if the price difference for that manufacturer is more than $150 for between like a 128 gigs and 256 gigs, which they typically are, it's usually $200.
Yeah.
You might not want that like sticking, off at all times, but if you're just doing extra storage on it, then
throw it in your bag.
Absolutely.
Photo library. Yeah. And I guess that'll do it for us this week then. As always, thank you guys. It's a good show. And today's outro comes to us from KJN.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Tested.
Gentlemen, take it away.